babies' blood, and vaccines, HIV vaccines, TB vaccines will be game changers for the HIV and TB epidemic. So we're very committed to working in a TB and HIV space. The most important thing that we are also interested in is our capacity development. And we're interested in developing a pipeline of South Africans that are diverse and committed to changing the health in South Africa. And I'll show you some of our plans on how we're addressing the pipeline in South Africa, the scientist pipeline, and how we are looking at innovative strategies of identifying people who are interested in science, and even in high school and in BSCs, and how to get into the pipeline so they can become scientists in the future. I think you all know this slide, but I think it's very important for us to pause and have a look at the 10 most common causes of mortality in South Africa. And what you can see from the slide is that South Africa has two imploding epidemics, one of communicable diseases and one of non-communicable diseases. But not only do we have these two imploding epidemics, we also have a huge burden of deaths that happen to pregnant women during delivery and just after delivery, and our neonates and infants, as well as the interplay of violence, gender-based violence in our communities, and injury, child accidents, car deaths, informal settlements, fires. These are all things that affect the health of our nation, and we need to address these issues. From the causes of this, you can see that not only is HIV and AIDS a huge killer of South Africans, but we are struck by an epidemic of hypertensive heart disease, cardiovascular disease, ischemic heart disease, which affects everybody in the country. And we have to make sure that we approach both the current burden of disease and also make sure that we are looking to the future and making sure we are addressing the impending epidemic that is about to come, particularly in the non-communicable disease space. We know that science and science and health changes lives more so than anything else, any other economic impact. And this is a very good example about how antiretroviral rollout has increased the life expectancy of South Africans. And this is a spectacular slide because no other intervention I know of can change life expectancy so quickly in such a short period of time. Normally we need 2 decades to change life expectancy by 5 years. And from 2003 to now, we managed to increase life expectancy by rolling out an antiretroviral for them. And this we should pause and be very proud of as South Africans. Not only are we increasing the lives of adults who are HIV infected, but we virtually are on the brink of eliminating pediatric HIV from South Africa by rolling out, by making sure that we diagnose HIV in pregnancy, initiating women on treatment and continuing their treatment for lifelong. We can ensure, one, that we can minimize breast milk transmission, reduce the rates of pediatric infection. And by identifying these HIV-exposed infants very early in life, we're probably the only country in the world that can address the HIV care agenda in infants. And we are critically poised to address the HIV care in children in a setting. I'll show you this slide because I want to show you the gains that we've made in under 5 and infant mortality rate. But I also want to show you what concerns me, and that's our neonatal mortality rate, which is at the bottom. So you can see the under 5 and infant mortality rate has continued to go down. And these have gone down because of rolling out PMBCT program and because we introduced life-saving vaccinations like rotavirus, haemophilus, and pneumococcal. So this is how you drive down mortality in under 5 and under 1. But we need a whole different strategy for how we drive mortality down in the neonate. And you can see since 2000, we haven't managed to drive mortality down in children in the first 28 days of life. And so one of our key objectives in the next 5 years is actually to deliver interventions that will push this down. And I'll show you later on some of the interventions that we have planned that are particularly going to address life in the first 28 days of life, and to try and drive down our mortality in children. Another thing, and the Honourable Minister of Health mentioned this in his budget vote talk last week, there are two things that cause death in pregnant women during labour and delivery, and the three H's. It's HIV, it's hemorrhage, and hypertension. And we in the South African Medical Research Council are investigating innovation that will be game changers in the space. Normally, to prevent postpartum hemorrhage, you need an intravenous infusion of something called oxytocin. We're working to make a formulation to put under your tongue. And so instead of a woman having to have a drip and having to be in a clinic, the woman can put the pill under her tongue and stop hemorrhage. And if this works, not only will it help women in South Africa, it will help women in Africa, in Asia, and in Europe. And so we're very proud to be working in a space to develop the first sublingual oxytocin that will be rolled out at a global level. In terms of tuberculosis, I don't have to tell the Honourable Committee they know the burden of TB in our country, both worldwide and in South Africa. We know the issues of extreme drug resistant TB and multi-drug resistant TB. And we are funding both diagnostic issues and treatment strategies to try and avert extreme drug resistant TB and multi-drug resistant TB. And why? You can see that extreme drug resistant TB and multi-drug resistant TB only consist of about under 3% of all our burden of TB. But if you look at the next slide, at 30% of the cost of managing TB is attributed to 2.2% of the TB epidemic. So we have to fund affordable drugs and we have to fund a pipeline. We're worried because the pipeline of TB drugs is drying up. And we need to make sure that we innovate in that space. We help fund innovation in drug development to address the high costs of these drugs in order to make sure that they can be affordable to South Africans. So how do we administer South African health research effectively and efficiently? And I'm going to show you some of the ideas that we've got. You know, we're interested in big ideas, big science that have high impact in South Africa. And we want to promote the knowledge economy. We're also interested in developing health solutions, and we are committed to improving the health of the nation, and we are also committed to developing research infrastructure to where it's never been before, and also human capacity in areas where we've never seen before either. We have a program where we introduce health innovation through our SHA program. We also have our flagship program, which drives the science agenda. We're committed to attaining the next generation scientists, and we also want to focus on both communicable and non-communicable diseases. We receive our money mostly through DOH and DST and through Treasury. We fund intramural and extramural research, both in the universities and within the medical research council. And we leverage our money to increase spend on research. And so we are busy working with the NIH, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and Wellcome to leverage money that we have. And I'm working on something called the Fairness Index. And that that for every one rand we put into a research project, I'm negotiating up to 5 rand that the other agency puts in, because that's the fair way to negotiate leverage. You will also see that we're working on drug pathogenesis and drug and vaccine discovery. We're looking at validating models for predicting type 2 diabetes. We're looking at the link between HLA and chronic TB disease. And we're also working on brain injuries during sports. And we have very good research platforms, and one of the jewels of MRC is our non-human primate facility, where we're able to do non-clinical research, look at models of TB, look at challenge models to see how our interventions protect or prevent disease, and using non-human primates as a model for humans before we get into human development. In terms of our TB, I'm sorry, that's very small. In terms of our TB, we fund about 23.5 million rand per year on TB. We have the biggest drug discovery project in the world, and we're also working on pediatric formulations. We're working on a PCR for diagnosing TB, which will have a 2-minute readout, and we're also investigating urine-based diagnostics, particularly for children, because it's very hard to diagnose TB in children, and if we had a mechanism where a nurse could test the urine of a child or an adult, we could, at the bedside or at the clinic or in the community, we could be able to diagnose TB rapidly. We are also interested in systems biology and bioinformatics, and we are investigating both transmission and the correlates of protection and disease in TB so that we can find the right TB vaccine and the right drugs for TB. For malaria, we have one of the largest drug discovery projects in Africa, so we're committed to supporting malaria work, even though we're not a high burden country. We are working in the entire life cycle of parasite. We have a clinical candidate that's been delivered, and we have backup series if we don't have good, if our first in-man study is not good enough. And we also have one of two infectories in South Africa. The only two malaria infectories in South Africa, one at NRCD and one in Durban under the MRC. And these are critical as we evaluate the insecticides and we evaluate models of trying to eliminate the mosquitoes in certain areas. I'm told that one of the ways, if we could eliminate malaria, if for 2 days everyone in the world took malaria prophylaxis, we could eradicate malaria. And this is one of the hypotheses that one of my scientists has at the Medical Research Council. Not only are we committed to malaria development and drug discovery, we also run the only GIS service to the SADC region where we monitor and monitor clinical outbreaks and surveillance so that we can plan and put the interventions with our partners in the SADC area to make sure that we have malaria control under our hat. In terms of supporting innovation and technology to improve health, I already told you that we have this new program called CHIP that's basically a product development partnership approach. And this is built on an unprecedented relationship between the Department of Science and Technology and the Department of Health. And we've also leveraged money from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And we basically are looking to fund diagnostics and medical devices, vaccines and drugs that address the problems that we have in South Africa. And this is an example. I actually have one here. So we know that 1 in 3 to 1 in 4 deaths in the first 28 days of life is due to birth asphyxia and intrauterine birth chart rehydration. Normally, we would not be able to predict these high risk pregnancies, because on the basis of it, these women look normal, they're gaining weight nicely. Well, when you see them at the clinic, they don't look like their babies are in trouble. But if we had to roll out a doctor mechanism that could look at uterine blood flow in the last few weeks of pregnancy, we could identify high-risk pregnancies that we could normally identify and save up to 1 in 3, 1 in 4 babies in the first 28 days of life. So if we are able to, we are really testing this, it's called the AmbiFlow, umbilical arteries doctor, and I've got it right here, we can show it around us now. And we can do it at a clinic level. We've been piloting this in Mamelodi and with the University of Pretoria, and basically believe that this will be a game changer in preventing early neonatal deaths that are related to decreased uterine blood flow that we could not have normally. We're also interested in ways of making healthcare work better in South Africa and trying to make sure that we can support primary healthcare nurses wherever they are with doctor support using our triage prototype. And this prototype basically helps nurses work with doctors who are not there from a remote area and help triage patients either to academic centers, regional hospitals, or to be managed in the community health clinic. And by rolling this out, we can properly manage the condition at every level and support primary health nurses in areas where they don't traditionally have doctors. In terms of our HIV program, we are very interested in drug formulations and treatment strategies. We're looking at, again, the pipeline is limited in HIV, and we have to address that. And we also look at ways of addressing latent reservoirs. So unless an HIV is active, we can't hit. And so we're trying to find a mechanism to activate HIV in its latent reservoir, and once it's activated, to kill it with the drug. And so that's one of our strategies to address HIV cure. We're also interested in other treatment strategies and also pediatric formulations. We are interested in diagnostics, trying to predict HIV risk in women, and trying to make sure that at a tick level, when we test for HIV resistance, we know immediately whether a person is resistant to HIV or not, and we can rapidly change the drugs that the patients are on. We're interested in other preventive strategies, so already know we're in a phase 3 microbe-sized study. If we're successful, we can go for licensure. The phase 3 tenofovir study is run only by South African consortium, and we will know the results towards the end of the year. But not only are we interested in the tenofovir gel strategy, we're looking further. We're looking at silver-based, using silver as an adjuvant to put to it with an antiretroviral to make the microbicide much more durable. And of course, I'm sure you know that South Africa is the flagship of HIV vaccine development and testing in Africa. South Africa and the Medical Research Council is the only country in Africa to ever develop a vaccine let alone an HIV vaccine. And this HIV vaccine, we had a clinical trial both in South Africa and in America, and we're in phase two. Based on the data that you see from the study, we will probably re-optimize the envelope immunogens and have a look at our vector and make and modernize our MVA vector. So this is just basic. Not only are we interested in active immunization, we're interested in passive immunization, looking at neutralizing antibodies infused early during pregnancy and delivery to prevent personal transmission further, or to use in the adult phase either to prevent HIV acquisition or to address the care agenda. And we're working very actively in this space. We're leading science in HIV vaccines. In terms of our platform, I already told you about our non-human primate facilities, where we're able to conduct research and look for challenge models. And so not only are we interested in the high-end vaccine discovery, we're also committed to developing clinical research capacity in areas in the country where we haven't seen seen clinical development. We are supporting various initiatives in the Eastern Cape, both laboratory support and clinical infrastructure, and we will be having RFAs that go out to address some of the historically disadvantaged universities in South Africa. Not only are we interested in discovery and in supporting capacity, we're also interested in community engagement, and are working very hard to make sure that whatever vaccine program we roll out, we've had community participation and engagement. Not only are we involved in HIV vaccine discovery, we're also part of a global participation. We are a member of the PIPAR consortium, which is to take the findings that we saw in RV144 in Thailand and show a vaccine to be moderately efficacious into South Africa. And already with the exact trial that was found to be moderately efficacious in Thailand, we have replicated in South Africa, and we hope to have the results towards the end of the year to see how we compare towards how Thailand compares. We're also supporting to the tune of 100 million. We have funding from the NIH and the Gates Foundation for $100 million to conduct a phase 3 HIV vaccine licensure study. The first phase of that begins in January, HPN100, and in 3 years' time we'll launch the phase 3 licensure study. It'll be the first time in the history of the world that we're going for, and we're going to do a phase 3 HIV vaccine licensure study, and South Africa is leading this effort. We also are interested in participating in other HIV vaccine efforts. In terms of non-communicable diseases, we are looking at an early diabetic diagnostic. Imagine, in this day and age, we can't even diagnose early gestational diabetes in pregnancy. Nowhere in the world is there a diagnostic to identify those pregnant women who have got diabetes. We have to use glucose tolerance tests. We have to get women to come in stock and over a period of time take blood and look at insulin. No one has developed an early diagnostic test to detect gestational diabetes, and we are going to be funding research in this area because this will not only change the lives of women in South Africa, but change the lives of women the world over. We're also interested in early diabetic drugs, and this just shows you the kind of work that we're doing in that, in our diabetic platform. We are funding in breast cancer, and we are funding in diabetes. So we're interested in pharmacogenomics and epigenetics, and we're looking to see how this interfaces with things like breast cancer and diabetes. So I know I'm going on, I know I'm sounding exciting, but you know, we have very exciting projects. And I'm going to just go on to our next exciting project, which is our flagship project. And I'm not going to say too much because you've got the information in your pack, but just to say that we are funding big projects in TB, HIV, stem cell research, and also stem cell research to look for an HIV cure, and we're also interested in mental health and cardiovascular and metabolic diseases. So we have the burden of disease covered, and we're doing high impact research in this area. We also have self-initiated research grants. These grants are for the young research or someone who's deciding to change their research strategy. And you can see basically where we're funding. We're funding traditional medicine, we're funding brain and behavior, we're funding maternal and child health, a significant amount of money in maternal and child health, TB and HIV. We're interested in health systems, and so you can see that we pay attention to the spread of our grants. One of our short, medium, and long-term goals is actually to build capacity for the long-term sustainability of the country's health research. So we committed to developing an MD, MDs, medical doctors who become PhDs. And we note that we've been charged, us in the medical schools have been charged to develop 1,000 MD PhDs in 10 years. And so we're contributing to this program through these various scholarship programs. And we are trying to target doctors to work toward a PhD so they can do clinical research. And these are at the tune of about R500,000 per annum. And this just shows you the amount of people that we've awarded it to. It shows you the distribution by university. And we also show you some of our career development awards, our postdoc awards, the people who've got their PhD. It's not just giving people their PhD. They have to be able to be transferred from their PhD into a postdoc so they can start writing grants and generating research. And so we committed not only to making PhDs, but to making sure that they're supported after they get their PhDs. We also fund not only our interest in doctors, interested in dentists and vets, and we are funding PhDs in the health and allied disciplines. And you can see how we not only are interested in PhD, but we're also interested in master's students. And so we already have 32 candidates for our master's and funding 32 candidates for our PhD. This just shows you the distribution of male, men and women by university and by institution and by race. And you can see that we're paying attention to the pipeline. And we have some nice data to show you how we're addressing the pipeline and how we envisage that the pipeline we've chosen with diversity will become the next leaders of our team South Africa. This slide shows you our PhD program. I wanted you to pay attention to the gender. We're getting lots of women to do medical research, which is very important, and you can see the distribution by university where our postgrad scholars are found. Here you can also see our National Health Scholars Program, and this is going to be our flagship program where we develop MD PhDs, and this is a tax-free scholarship, full-time PhDs, and it's the total value is 15 million rand at the moment, and we're really negotiating to get additional funding. And you can see the amount of people in the first call and how we managed to increase it in the second call. You can also see the representation that, unlike the past, almost half the people applying for our postgrad and our Scottish program are not white. And so this for us is a huge movement that our pipeline, we're addressing the pipeline in a very concerted and strategic way. You can just see the distribution by university where all these people are. UKZN and UCT drive it. And we're working on making sure that other institutions also take up this opportunity. And we also have people that study abroad, sometimes particularly in bioinformatics or special laboratory things. We send people abroad to learn the field so that they can bring it back and help us in South Africa. This just shows you the gender representation by first and second call. You can see that women are interested in science. And this shows you the distribution in the universities, and it shows you that we're also sending people abroad again. This just shows you who we are funding. We're funding medical practitioners, physiotherapists, optometrists, audiologists, biomedical engineering. We need biomedical engineers to help us with the R&D and health innovation in South Africa. One of our other important strategic goals is to use the generation of new knowledge and make sure that whatever you find in the clinic, we transfer to improve health. And this just shows you, I'm going to rush through this, that you have all of this in your packs, but this shows you the kind of stuff that South African scientists are working in. Everything from high speed and biologically relevant alignments of high throughput sequencing reads decoding DNA to gamma interferon biomarkers for TB, to other biomarkers of immune activation, to health system performance, to host virus vaccine development, to energy metabolism, drug and drug effects in mycobacterium TB, to gender-based violence, and that's in me there, to HIV vaccine research, to working in malaria treatment, and to working in HIV infections. And you can see from the spread, you know, that we're doing everything from discovery to things that matter in the community, and so we make sure that we have our pipeline covered. MRT lead the whole campaign on lead poisoning. We identified lead, we had very high levels of lead in our children's blood, and we know that lead impacts on intellect. And the MRC led the whole campaign and the legislation to address the issue of lead in paints and lead in fuel. And by doing this, you know, we can increase the IQ of children 3 or 4 points just by doing this with lead. And, you know, we are completely committed to making sure that even in other communities, we're finding in other communities that people are smelting stuff in front of children and they're breathing in lead, and we need to address that, particularly in fisher communities. So basically, in order to raise an awareness of lead. Alcohol and HIV is very important, and we're looking at ways of optimizing adherence in the effect of alcohol and to try and address the alcohol issues that we have in South Africa. We're also making discoveries between HLA and chronic TB disease. This is very important. We know very little. For 70 years, we've not done enough work on TB, and we know very little about what protects people from TB and what accelerates disease. And understanding HLA and chronic disease will help us to design programs and diagnostics that help us prevent TB disease. Brain injury is important. We are a country of sportsmen, and we are already doing research to make sure how we can identify risk factors for sports concussion and how we can improve that we don't have our sportsmen in brain injuries. Intimate partner violence is very important. The work that we've done in South Africa has changed global practices and we are leading initiatives both in South Africa and on interventions to prevent intimate partner violence. HIV counseling and testing, we are looking at how to roll out HIV counseling and testing in optimal ways, and we're supporting government in this to identify new models to roll out VCT. We leverage resources. I've spoken a little bit about the leveraging, and I think Nick, my financial person, is going to continue. But you know, we are kind of committed to working to make sure we leverage money in a way to do cutting edge research in South Africa that has high impact. So now I'm going to ask Nick to give our financial report, and I'll come back with 3 slides about why sound is important in South Africa, why it's important for our health and wealth. Thanks, Nick.
Thank you. Good morning, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members. I'll be very brief and just talk through the numbers. The President has given you all these exciting projects, great things that we're doing in medical research. Obviously, the money's got to come from somewhere, and I'll just briefly take the committee through the sources of the income. This gives you our income breakdown from 2013-14 right the way through to 2017-18, which is the end of the current NPA period. I'll just dwell on the 2015-16, which is the next budget year. The main allocation comes from national government, and you can see that's the first line. That's what we call our permanent baseline allocation, and that's projected to be 408 million for the next financial year. And then we have another line also coming from government called the Economic Competitive and Support Package. We did a motivation for funding in that area, the idea being that a healthy population is a healthy workforce and a competitive workforce. So we researched the health of the people are. So we're very successful there, and we've actually received 131 million in 2015-16. So that gives us a total of 540 million that's coming from the national government. Then we have other income, which is generated internally, investment income from our investments of 27 million, overhead recovered of 23 million, where we actually recover from funders for the funding and use of our corporate infrastructure, then sundry income through various leases of buildings, MRC buildings. So that really is our total, what we call our total baseline income. And then we have contact funding. We have DST funding, Department of Science and Technology for the SHIP, which the President has mentioned, which is 57 million. The Gates Foundation of 40 million, and that's really given us 100 million over the last two financial years. And then the next line called the Leverage Funding, which is projected at 35 million. It's very, very important that we're using the funding that we receive from government to generate additional funding. So for every rand that we actually allocate to this, we get a rand in return. And if the President is successful with a parity, we should probably get more than a rand in return given the exchange rate. So that's effectively a minimum of 100% return on investment. So I would, in anybody looks, those are sound investments financially. And we're projecting approximately 250 million from that source of funding. What we're trying to do as well is to get that income, that leverage funding, into our own books, which obviously means that we can manage the money. We have foreign exchange coming into the country, which is obviously a very good thing. And we will manage that funding and direct that to research. And lastly, what we call contract research funding, which in 2015-16 is estimated at $222 million. So those are funds from where we actually apply for foreign grants from the National Institute of Health in the U.S. and various other funding institutions where we actually receive money to conduct research on their behalf or in collaboration with those organizations. That gives us a total estimated funding of close on R1 billion for 2015-16. And that really has been a step change in 2014-15 of some 51%. So I think we've actually reached a new level of funding, although I'd just like to raise one area of concern where we're seeing a drop off of $15 million in 2017-18 in government funding. I would hope to see that replaced because obviously that's a downward trend that will have a significant impact on our flagship projects and also the ability to actually use that money to generate that return through the leverage funding where we have been so successful. This just gives you an idea of the projected growth in income, and it actually shows the total budget, which is our total income budget, versus our baseline allocation, which is effectively our government funding. And it's slightly over 50%, so I think that's a good thing because we're still obviously following the higher government funding, the higher we follow the national health agenda, which I think is critically important in our funding levels. But that also shows the drop-off that I mentioned in 2017-18, and we would hope to see that arrested to continue on the upward trend that we've actually seen over the last few years. This just shows you a breakdown between the major spending opportunities, and we can see that if we look at the major spending areas of that money, most of it goes to what we call intramural research, where the actual units of the research are done in-house by MRC-employed scientists. That's $360 million. Extramural research, where we actually divert funds to the major universities, mainly to the universities in the country, for actual research done by universities through an application process, $210 million. Research capacity development, $33 million. SHIP, which the President did mention, that's $186 million. And you can see that it's 140% increase year on year. That's investment in diagnostic products, actual products that we can actually use in the medical sphere. So you can see the SHIP initiatives have been very successful. And you can see that most of that funding is actually coming from external sources, Bill and Melinda Gates and other areas. So that's shown a significant increase. And then the other area is support, so all our support functions, finance, HR, etc., at $159 million. So that gives you some idea in terms of where the money is going overall. This just breaks the same numbers effectively down into the four key strategic areas that the President has mentioned. The first one being administration. The idea is to ensure that we're managing the money effectively and efficiency. We did receive a clean audit status in 2012-13, and that also helps us in that the money that our funders know and government knows that the money that's coming into the organization is actually going to where it's needed. It's actually compliant in terms of all the regulations, and we're actually getting bang for money in terms of our procurement spend. So I think that's a very, very valuable tool that we use as we try and generate additional finance for the organization. And you can see that we're becoming more efficient. If you look at the average percentage of total spend on administration, it's reducing from 23.9% average to 18.3%. So, in fact, if you look at the house year itself, the total admin costs are only 15% of our total spend. And you can see that we're actually making sure that more and more of money is received actually go into research, which I think is very important. The core research area is actually $659 million. Which is an average of 62.9% of the total spending going to actual core research, and then 15% of that, the total spending, is going into innovation technology and products in the medical sector. So all of it is being diverted to where it's needed into research. And just then, just as a summary of the major highlights from a financial perspective, we're anticipating income will grow by 31% in 2015-16 in the current economic environment. I think that's a relatively good performance. We are anticipating leverage funding of 35 million rand for 3 years from the Newton Wellcome Trust in the UK, and Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in the USA. We also have further leverage funding, which we've actually already secured, which is 14 million rand per annum for 3 years from the National Institute of Health in the US, although that is off balance sheet. It's not actually coming through our books. Our spending on administration in relation to total costs will decrease from 24% in 2014 to 18.3% in 2017-18, so our efficiencies are improving. I mean, just to raise that note of concern on the reduction of funding by 15 million in 2017-18. Thanks very much. I'll hand back to my friend.
So I'm going to, obviously the reduction in funding is of a great concern to me, and I'm going to show you why it's important that we fund R&D in the health sector. So this gets pretty, but this shows you the amount of publications that South Africans do over time. And you can see that, post-democracy and in 2000 we're increasing the number of publications that we have. But in 2012 we still were only 0.73% of the global contribution to science. And so although we can better, we are little. We are not publishing enough at a global level. However, we need to take into account population and everything. So I'm going to show you some slides. So if you look at the United States and the United Kingdom and our BRICS and Japan counterparts, you can see this just gives you the total number of publications we're doing, the number of citations, and our share of the world contribution. And so in terms of publications, so we've published like 10,000 in comparison to 350,000 plus minus from the United States and 100,000 from the United Kingdom. So you can see if we look at these contributions, we're not contributing a lot in terms of actual publications. But if you address the kind of things that we have in South Africa that disadvantage us, if you have a look at our tertiary gross enrollment ratio and our unemployment rate and our life expectancy and our GDP that spend on research and the amount of full-time research that we have in South Africa, you can see that in fact we do quite spectacularly. If you look at our publications for 100 million of R&D expenditure, South Africa is 244 as compared to the United States that is 90. So if you look at our unemployment rates, if you look at our life expectancy, if you look at our tertiary gross enrollment ratio, in fact, South Africa is a jewel in BRICS and in the world. And this is why it's very important to continue to contribute despite our disadvantages of what we have. We've done very good. We have value for money in this thing as a big concern. And I think that's important. It's very important to know the relationship between knowledge and wealth. And this has been recognized from time immemorial. And even Napoleon said, there cannot be a great nation without great mathematics. And so if our country does not commit to R&D and science and technology, we can never, ever be wealthy or healthy. And if you look, the slide also doesn't predict poorly, but scientific productivity is a much better predictor of economic wealth and human development than any other industry. And that we're being silly if we don't see the opportunity to invest in health R&D and invest in science and technology and to make sure that we continue to not only contribute to the health of our nation, but we contribute to the wealth of our nation as well. So I'm going to end by saying thank you to the Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members. I want to acknowledge our funders and the support that we have from other science councils and other agencies. And I do have the Doppler here, and we'll show it around. And I'm hoping that this Doppler is going to save 1 in 4 babies alive in the first 24 hours of life. And so I think that this kind of doctor has the potential to be revolutionary and a game changer for our healthcare system. So thank you very much.
This is what it looks like. You can have a look at it later. Anyone pregnant in the audience?
Thank you very much. Now, questions. Honorable Nsale, Honorable Maisela, Honorable Ndaba, Honorable James, Honorable Wormwood and the Honourable all that which is administered. I didn't ask Honourable James and the rest of the Honourable Skipper in that order. And I will be the last to then pick up some few questions. Thank you.
Okay, no, thanks. Let me first appreciate the presentation, a very good presentation from Mata. But I think there are a number of questions that I would like to pose. The first question relates to your page 4 and page 9, I think, of the both the strategic plan and the annual performance, and I think it's the same, issues. We see that you have closed a number of research units. I'm talking about, not in the presentation, yeah, in your documents that you submitted prior, yes, the green one and the blue one. The green represent the ANC, the blue represent the DA.
That's on a lighter note.
Unfortunately, the red is not yet presented. the first question is, why the closures? Why did you close so many units? And what has been the impact with regard to your staff? You know, when those particular units were closed, and what has been the staff turnover? The second question relates to the program that was launched by the minister, you know, on HPD. Just for interest, have you done the research on that? Is there some dead effects? Has there been some deaths noted from the program itself? The third question for me would be, what has been the contribution of Business South Africa in your research programs? That I see it's not actually reflected there, especially on your HIV and TB programs, which affect mostly the workforce and so on and so forth. I think for now these are my the questions that I would like to pose to yourself. No. The other one is, in the document you have proposed amendment to the legislation, but it's not very clear which amendments are you referring to. The changes that you are referring to, and when will this amendment be brought to Parliament? So briefly, those are the questions for me from myself. Thank you.
Before the next one, remember, there's a lady at the back who came in. Can you please introduce yourself using the mic? Use the mic.
My name is Omishara. I'm from Parliamentary Monitoring Group.
Yes, just to make everybody at ease, this thing that we want people to introduce themselves is that when something comes up and we're looking at, who said this way, so we must know who is here, and all the deliberations in the committee are being recorded so that we are able to trace. So I want everybody to be comfortable on that. Honorable Maite.
Thank you, Chair. I've got a litany of questions here. I don't even know where to start, which one to ask, but maybe I'll try to sort them out. I see that your research is biased towards the diagnostic and the curative and not the preventative side of things. And maybe that's the first question. Why the bias towards curative and diagnostic, not prevention? And the public health loses a lot of money or pays a lot of money to outside diagnostic laboratories to try and help them in there. And you are there to do these things and, I don't know, help to stem that money. Because the people who were in the system go out and see the loopholes and then set themselves up. And there was a problem recently where the department were trying to, or those people were trying to close up their labs because there was a lot of money that are owing, just circulating money or throwing the javelin. But that's another story. You are supposed to help in unraveling that and actually getting the diagnostic thing happening very efficiently and effectively, because that's where the bias of your research is mostly geared towards. And, okay, there is an overlap between what you are doing with the DST and so on and so on. I think maybe that one should be ironed out so that when next time we meet, that thing is ironed out and you are cooperating effectively and efficiently and sharing the pattern of what you are doing. Now, I haven't seen a very strong message about what you are doing in researching the social causes of diseases. And that's very important, I think, as part of your research, I think, money to search those things. So then that will help the department to try and come up with preventative social measures to stop this. The other very glaring hangover, whatever, bringing forward, is the transformed nature of your department. It's so glaring that I think you could cut it with a hacksaw. So maybe you could explain why there is not even a what you call it. You don't even try to transform the data scope antebellum or whatever. It is still there as huge as it was before. So maybe if you could explain that. Oh, I really loved when you talked about mosquitoes.
Sorry,
the order to stop mosquitoes.
Sir, Honourable Member, can we agree that in the first round we will try and ask two to three questions in the first round so that they are then able to. I'm suggesting that I'm stopping you there. When we are in the next round, you then come back again to your other questions that are remaining.
Okay, thank you, Chair. I was thinking that we ask the questions and they start sorting them out while others are asking questions, and then when they answer, we don't have to go back and forth. Thank you.
Honourable James?
Jefferson, close my
question. Honourable James?
Thank you. Thank you very much, Chair. I have two questions. One's a science question, the other one's a funding question. And the science question is, I mean, if the two most significant points that you made in your presentation has to do with HIV, the HIV vaccine is in a second round of clinical trials, and the funding question in relation to R&D expenditure while currently in order to grow seriously the knowledge economy, usually expressed in terms of the ratio between R&D expenditure across the board and our GDP. The science question, I mean, if you find a successful vaccine for HIV, which is preventable, by the way, prevent disease, so that's a big expenditure, then you'd probably be eligible for a nuclear for a Nobel Prize in the area of physiology and medicine, not chemistry. Principally because you've cracked the science problem, and you know it better than I do. But my understanding is that the science problem is here is a little big one, in that there is a natural immunity for HIV in most human populations. And vaccines stimulate and enhance weak natural immunity and there is no natural immunity. So, and how you did that is a science question I'm asking. Which side of the immune system did you tackle? And what is the actual science of cracking that problem? So that's my first question. Related to that, also why there is no, what's the science problem to be cracked, to be solved, to get a vaccine for tuberculosis, which is a bacterial infection, so it's a different kind of science, obviously. So that's my first question. I just, by the way, I worked at David Baltimore at Caltech for a year, not as a biologist, but as a social scientist, and he developed a gene therapy replacement approach to HIV with Gates. So the second question has to do with funding. when you're playing in the big science lead, you're associating yourself with a big funder globally, Gates, Wellcome Trust, NIH, and so on. And you're doing this with high-cost brains in the country, drawing on the medical community and the science community, on a very small budget. So if you were to add up all the money that's spent on medical research in the country, both on the public side and the private side, it's actually very small. And so, and I think if we want to continue playing the big globally, both in the human health side and the animal health side, which we're quite good at as a country, then, and the plant side actually, then what we need to do is that the South African community, including government, that may take care of it. And what the Lady Ponder does, Minister of Health, Minister of Science, is in fact set a target to get our R&D expenditure as a proportion of R&D to match other developing countries, and the target is 2, I think. And we're under 1%. And so she definitely is committed to putting the money in from the science and technology side, but others have to contribute to the party. I mean, I noted, by the way, that the budget for PhD students is 60,000 a year. You can't do it at 60,000 a year. I mean, you really need more money from higher education and training. I mean, they really have to be. Anyway, so my question is, well, actually just an observation, that I think that your budget is way too small for what you do. And if you want to play in the big league, then we need to up the budget, and part of it has to come from public side, from government side, and part from the private side.
Honorable members, as we do in the House, we don't call ministers by their honorable.
Thank you very much. Honorable Chair, I just have 3 quick questions. And let me quickly say, though, that congratulations. You clearly are doing substantive work along your mandate, and on looking at the burden of disease, I think with a very, very clear focus, and the work you're doing is saving lives. So congratulations. I've got 3, as I said, questions. The first is to do with funding. If you look at where the squeeze is, it appears to come out of that economic competitive support package. I mean, you had an increase in 2015-2016, a plateau at 2016-17, and then a dip by 37% in 2017-2018. And the arguments the President made of the MRC for access to that grant, I think, were pretty sound. So just the question is, why is it that squeeze? Along with that funding question, do you receive RINC funding, research incentive grant funding for publications? And also, as publications are a primary sort of out indicator, is that creating a bit of a publication bias? In other words, are you going after research that can guarantee positive results as opposed to taking a much more kind of objective approach because you need to get the publications out there? The second question links to translation of research, and you spoke about the need to translate research into policy and practice. Now, sometimes it's very difficult. It's difficult to get policymakers to understand complexities of statistical analysis, you know, building odds ratios and risk ratios in a way that's meaningful for them. And have you thought about how to bridge that gap? In other words, getting capacity around translating scientific findings into clear policy recommendations that can be taken up and implemented. The last question really links back to tuberculosis. We know that drug-resistant tuberculosis is a huge issue, and there have been novel drugs that have been proposed to actually may have efficacy. Are you involved in any RCTs with any of these drugs? And also, the latest World TB report spoke about more than 20 other vaccines being in a TB vaccine pipeline. Are you kind of involved in any of those vaccine trials? Thank you.
James? Thank you, Chair. I just want to know what is MRC doing on oral health, because I'm looking at page 43. I don't see it as a priority, and I think it is, especially to children, you know, in terms of prevention and access.
Thank you. Honorable Skipper?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Chair, I would just like to know what are the provincial targets that are
added to your mic?
Oh, I'm sorry. what are the provincial targets that are aimed at addressing indicators as reflected in your APP? Thanks, Chair.
Honourable Ndaba, as you are coming in. From my side, it will be on page 36, bullet point number, on the presentation itself, bullet point number one, it says support for national community engagement efforts. How are those being done, if I can be clarified? You have also spoken on the issues of gender, science, whatever. We would appreciate, even if you can give us at some other time, the breakdown of the gender. Okay, plus, we can be females. Whereas it's females who are coming from class and race, that for us is very important, so that we are then able to measure what Honourable my fellow was saying in terms of transformation, but we do request that to happen. A comment from me, in your APP, your funding is not as the breakdown as the presentation, and I don't think that it's fair to us. I don't think it's fair because you have just only either a page, and when we're looking into the APP and the presentation that we have just received, we're not saying we should have received, but would have appreciated if when you then you gave us the pack, you gave us that you gave us your APP with the exact breakdown, so that we are able to make our comparison and be able to really ask some questions. And I think as a chair, it's an area where really you have been a bit unfair to us. What we'll do now, we'll give you time to respond and then allow members again to ask some questions, because only to myself do have some other questions too.
Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, thank you for the questions that you've asked me. I'm going to start with the closing of the interim unit. There was a CT review and an Academy of Science review of the MRC a few years ago. And what it found was a bloated organization that was funding in an incoherent way. There's lots of duplication. And we weren't getting value for money. And so because of the lack of value for money and the fact that we weren't funding research that was addressing what was killing people in South Africa, a whole review and revitalization of the MRC occurred. And with that, the units that weren't productive and weren't addressing the health needs of the country and were duplicating work were closed down. And this was this wasn't just willy-nilly. You know, we didn't just go eeny, meeny, miny, mo, or I don't like you because, we fought when we were hunted. This was done in a set of criteria was drawn up, and the criteria had to address the issue around burden of disease and productivity and, and value for money spend. And based on this, units were closed down in the intramural space, and we now have a intramural program that is streamlined and will address the burden of disease. HIV prevention unit, we have a diabetic platform, we have a TB unit, and these are critically poised to answer the questions going forward. And so, and this is something that we will continue to monitor. You know, I want scientific productivity. I want value for money. I want to know that the public money that I'm spending, I'm getting good value for. And so we've been talking as the board and as senior scientists in the country, how we measure productivity and how we hold our scientists to the productivity and make sure that we get value for money and impact. And so there have been staff turnover, and there was a whole protected engagement with staff and staff did leave the organization, and they have either gone to universities or other places, and here maybe can comment on where the human resources went to. But what we do have at the moment is a lean intramural program, which we should have. The model all over the world is actually to fund extramurally. We're unusual. Most people in the world, whether it's the British MRC or whether it's the Australian MRC, and even I've had discussions with the NIH, that we should be spending most of our money in the extramural space and only have intramural units for things that we can't do anywhere else. And so that's the model in international, and that's how we get productivity. And so, we want to avoid duplication, and we want to make sure that we get value for the spend that we get. And so that was the reasons for closing the intramural unit. And I'm glad to say that the intramural units we have now are critically poised to address the burden of disease in our country. In terms of HPV vaccination, scientists in South Africa have been involved in the evaluation of HPV vaccine. Work has been done in young men and women and in adults, in HIV-infected and uninfected individuals. We know the immunogenicity profile. The HPV program has been rolled out the world over and even in Africa. And I don't know exactly how many millions of people women have got the vaccine the world over, but with pharmacovigilance is done whenever you introduce a vaccine into a country or into the globe. There's something called pharmacovigilance, and any adverse event or anything that happens is reported, and to date there have not been any deaths attributed to HPV vaccination. It's a safe vaccine. We understand the correlates of protection. We understand how it works against cervical cancer. We know the subtypes that cause cervical cancer, and the vaccine candidates that are there are poised to avert the serotypes that cause cervical cancer. In terms of business, South Africa, you raise an important point. We don't have good philanthropy in the country, and we don't have good angel philanthropy, and we don't have good programs where mining companies or industrial people contribute, tobacco companies contribute to addressing the health needs of the country. And I've been looking at that. We do get some funding from diseased estates, and mostly around cancer. And we are looking at how we can get those angel philanthropists and big business to see the value of science, particularly that affects their workforce. I mean, he's a senior owner, so we should get commitment. We should be getting money from I should be getting money from the tobacco sale so that we can basically invest in the health of the country. In terms of the legislation for the MRC Act, you are correct. We have an MRC Act, which is busy. We're busy looking at it. It's under review. We're taking discussion. Once the board is happy with some of the suggestions, there will be public consultation with everybody around the MRC Act. But some of the issues pertain to who should be the head. So at the moment, as the current Act says, the person that has to be the head of the MRC must be a doctor. And the question we're saying is this appropriate? Should a doctor be the head of an MRC, or should it be a scientist? And so those are the kind of discussions we're having. So that's just one of the philosophical discussions. Some of the other stuff is around the governance, but everybody will be well consulted before we do anything about it. In terms of the research, my honourable member, you asked about the bias towards diagnostics and curative. I would say that we're assessing the whole value chain of disease in South Africa, and yes, we are spending money in trying to find an affordable and early diagnosis for TB, and trying to find cures for illnesses. But we also spend a lot of money in the preventative space, particularly on gender-based violence, PNPT programs to improve adherence. We're also working in violence injury and peace, where we're looking at childhood injuries, fires that happen in informal settlements, and looking at a multi-component intervention that looks at saving children's lives by introducing a program that's based at a community level. So that's how we are addressing. So we are on in terms of prevention as well. We're also working at curable and prevention. We're also looking at TB vaccines, HIV vaccines, as the preventing disease and early screening issues around obesity and exercise to try and prevent disease, and also to look at early screening for hypertension. We don't do enough screening for blood pressure in communities, and we don't diagnose enough hypertension that could be basically save people's lives. So we do need to work on that. We're rolling out a demographic health survey this year to help the department understand the burden of disease as we currently know it, and we'll be looking at blood pressure, and we'll be looking at other biomarkers so we can make some meaningful and quantitative efforts to address some of the preventive things like hypertension. In terms of the outside diagnostic companies, it is true that that often pharmaceuticals or biotechs are involved in developing diagnostic platforms, and we then have to pay huge amounts of money for it. And this is why we're interested in public-private partnerships, so that we both take the risk and we both benefit. So if the risk and the benefit is mutual, and we are working with intellectual property issues around royalty and how we work to make sure that when we do have an HIV vaccine that does work, we can afford it, and we can make it, and we can distribute it. And so that's how we are moving towards, in the MRC, we have a nice unit that's set up to address the issue around intellectual property to make sure that the discoveries we make in science in South Africa we benefit from. In terms of the DST DOH overlap, we do get funding both from the DST and the DOH, and we work together very closely with them. We have them represented on our steering committees in our financial allocation to make sure that the money we get from both departments is used well, and there's no overlap, and that everybody is clear about what initiatives the DST is funding and what initiatives the DOH funding. And we want the DST and DOH to work together with us at a scientific oversight and governance committee so that we can make sure our spend is not duplicated. In terms of the social causes of disease, you're right. We do need to understand the determinants of disease, and we are. We're looking at the interplay of alcohol and drug use and how it relates to disease, and we have huge programs on it. We're looking at fecal alcohol syndrome and how we can prevent it, some of the issues around fecal alcohol syndrome and alcohol use during pregnancy. We also are looking at gender-based violence and trying to understand what are the interventions we can put in at a societal level that will impact on intimate partner violence and gender. And, of course, we are interested in children who die in car accidents, who die because they get shot in the fields, or they die because something has happened to them. So to address the fact that not only do children die of infectious diseases, they die of other diseases which we are studying and tracking. They die in fires in their houses, and we need to look at ways of preventing it and tracking it. In terms of transformation, you're correct. One of the reasons why I was appointed is because I have a transformation agenda. I am a woman, so that's fast. I have a final job, and my final job is to transform the MRC, and I'm going to be picked on that. And I wish I could show you, and maybe we can send this to you. And this just shows you my pipeline. So yes, at this moment in time, the top management doesn't look at the way we would like to look at it. We do have on our executive management committee, have Jeff, who's our new vice president. We have Umbrelo, who's our HR executive, and we have Kosana Tibuka, who's our legal representative. We have myself, and we have Nick. And so really, even at the top management, we're addressing the issue. So, my job is to replace myself, and I'm going to do that. If you could look at my pipeline, you'd be much more encouraged. Because if you see my academically qualified early stage investigators, they're exactly where they should be. And these are people I'm going to grow to the top. And so it takes the, so this is a 5-year program, but we have 89 black female scientists, 51 colored female scientists, 44 Indian female scientists, and only 17 black female scientists. So you really can see that I'm addressing the pipeline, and I'll be paying attention, and we're growing the pipeline, and we're going to make sure that our pipeline grows and always reflects the demographics of South Africa. So we are committed to that, and I can also show you the men. And so it's on our, you know, we know it's a problem and we're addressing it. And hopefully we'll continue to address it. In terms of the HIV vaccine, yes, we've done a lot of work both as understanding the pathogenesis and mechanisms of protection in HIV vaccine, as well as partner with other institutions who are developing vaccines. I'm going to answer both your questions on HIV vaccine together. The issue is that if we crack the HIV vaccine, you know, we stand to win a Nobel Prize. The HIV vaccine development will be an iterative process. So at the moment, we have an HIV vaccine that was developed that is found to be about 33% efficacious in Thailand. And if you look at the way the vaccine performed, it was most durable at about a year after getting the vaccination, about 60%. And so what we've done, we've taken the findings and we've adjuvanted the protein boost to increase durability and potency of the vaccine. We've also looked at the protein that was used, and we now have a bivalent protein that's taken the KHC envelope and has made it KHC specific. And we've also looked at the vector, and we looked at the inserts, and we've put KHC inserts into the vector. And so I am convinced that this vaccine will be moderately efficacious, and we're looking for 50%. Now, we're not there yet with the Nobel Prize. You know, once we have a sterilizing vaccine, we might do it. But we have to then look at other ways. So, you know, we know that to protect against HIV, we need active and passive immunization. You know, we need to bring in neutralizing antibodies, and we need to actively stimulate both the humoral and cellular side of the immune system. And this work being planned in this space, but it's probably a 10-year project. And we, South Africa, has one of the best pipelines of identifying neutralizing antibodies, and already we are working with manufacturing agencies to try and get these neutralizing antibodies genetically engineered as monoclonals or whatever to test and evaluate in to prevent breast milk transmission, to evaluate in the cure, and to keep on working. So in terms of the vaccine that we are going to test coming up, we do know what the correlates of protection are. They know we get V1, we get IgG to V1V, we get antibodies to the IgG antibodies to the V1VT loop. And in particular the V2 loop, we will protect, moderately protect South Africans. These vaccines will wane with time, and we'll have to look at boosting. And so we will proceed very carefully and make sure that we don't spend $100 million on a vaccine that's not going to work. We're going to be a carefully executed vaccine trial, and we already are looking at how vaccine used in the TAR study looks in South Africans. We have issues in South Africa. We know that body mass index reduces your vaccine-induced immune responses, that the lighter you are or the smaller you are, the better your immune system is. And so we are worried that alcohol also reduces your immune responses. So those are the kind of things that we are going to be evaluating in these vaccines. In terms of TB vaccines, we're far behind, you know, at a global level, not even South Africa. We don't even know where to start. The immunogens we stick in these vaccines are prehistoric. The platforms are pathetic. You know, no one has paid attention to TB vaccines. We need to look at crystallography, we need to look at structural biology, and we need to understand, you know, the variable and non-variable areas of TB and design vaccines. You know, we mustn't do empirical research in HIV, in TB vaccines anymore. We have to have a structured approach. We have to design vaccines that look at the structure of TB. And this is the one thing that I'm committed to. I'm committed to doing a whole lot of work in trying to understand, so what are the correlates of protection in TB vaccines. You know, we have people, healthy workers, who breathe TB in day in and day out and never get the TB infection, and they never get TB disease. And then we have some person who exposed once gets TB disease. So what makes this person that breathes TB in day in and day out never get a disease? You know, we don't understand the correlates. No one has looked at what protects people and what doesn't, and we need to be working in that space. In terms of funding, yes, we have small budget, okay, but we also add a lot of value. You know, we have good scientists, we have good infrastructure, and we have the burden of disease. And so we contribute a lot in terms of value add. We do need to have more money. You know, I need 2 or 3 billion to really make a difference here, 1 billion. And we do need to understand that we need to make sure that we do bring in more money into health R&D, and that our expenditures work carefully and that we manage our funds carefully. So I do agree that I would like to see a bigger budget. You know, the NIH, I'm like a pauper, and I don't see the NIH because they have these huge budgets and they're doing big science, and we need to advise to that as well. In terms of PhD training, I'm looking at all different models of training. How do I get a doctor to become a PhD, and where do I find them? You know, do I have an intercalated PhD, MD, who then takes 2 years out and has a PhD and then come back and finish the medical science? Do I get the specialist to do a PhD, or do I find the BSCs and get them to do PhDs, or do I go into high school? And I do all of that. You know, and there are short-term gains, there are mid-term gains, there are long-term gains. And I'm looking at different models. So the University of Alabama, in the Duke South, had an issue about minorities and minority representation in research and development. And I've looked at their model, and they've gone right into the community, and they have spectacular ways of addressing this. And so I'm going to be looking at adapting some of those models into South Africa, and they have offered to work with me. I'm also on the Dean's Committee for Health, and we will be developing a program and discussing how we move PhDs along the pipeline in the medical area to improve clinical research. In terms of funding, I think you're the best person to answer this in terms of the economic support. But I'm going to talk about the RINC. At this moment in time, medical research scientists are only honorary professors or honorary members of the university, and so all the publications that my scientists get, the university that they honorary associated with get the money. So we actually don't get the money, and I'm working with the department, the medical school. So actually, I want our scientists to be full members of universities, have joint appointments like we have in the government, the hospital and the universities. So that's something that we need to see the benefits of our RINC, because that will help me also generate more science and money. In terms of the publication bias, you're good. In terms of talking about publication bias, and you know, are we just pushing out papers? And we had a debate about this, about in a country level, like what is scientific impact, what is scientific productivity, and what is the phenotype of a productive scientist. And it's everything. It's training PhDs. It's conducting high class research. It's changing practice. And so it's not just about high impact journals. You know, a good example was the Orange Farm male circumcision study. This study was published in one of the lowest impact journals. The big impact journal Lancet rejected it. And this little study in Orange Farm in Soweto has changed the world in preventing HIV acquisition. And so that's a good example that you don't need to publish in high impact journals to change clinical science. And that is something that we do have to pay attention to. We are having the discussion about scientific productivity and scientific impact and what does that mean. And it's not just about high impact journals, it's about a whole lot of other things. And so we were developing a specific phenotype for the scientists and what I would like to see happen in South Africa. In terms of the TBS, we are working. We are funding the next study, and that's looking at an RCT, looking at multi-drug and extreme drug resistant TB, looking at various combinations of drugs to address that issue. So that is something that we are doing, and we're also doing some clinical research in pediatrics in children who can't understand the burden of multi-drug resistant in pediatrics. In TB vaccine, we are involved, and you know, I'm involved because I want to see, I want empiric vaccine design in the TB space, and I want the design must make sense. And we need structural biologists in this country. You know, we don't do enough of understanding the structure or the crystallography of TB or any of our organisms. And so we have a much better understanding if we can do that. So I do think that's an important thing. We want evidence based and rational vaccine design in the TB space. In terms of the oral health, at the moment, South Africa and the MRC, not South Africa, but MRC has mostly concentrated on things that kill South Africans. And we need to get to the areas where we address issues of morbidity. And so, and I agree with you about the morbidity of having oral problems, and it's something that we need to address as we slowly chip off the burden of disease of things that kill us, and then we can address some of the other things that impact on our quality of life. So we do hear the honourable member. In terms of provincial targets, our job is to make sure that the indicators we do are represented in all the provinces. So we fund research everywhere in the country, in every province, and we track our indicators as is measured by our scientific output and our indicators which we've given you. And so this is the way we make sure that our provincial targets are met, and we're happy to share that stuff with you, and just now Nick and Sarah can say something about it. The community engagement efforts are very important and are critical, because unless community is working closely with scientists, we can never roll out interventions. And we've learned with HIV that community engagement is important. And the most important thing is to have a sound theoretical framework with how we work in communities. And we work from, you know, we have community members on our ethics committee. We have community members on our protocols. We give input to the way the study is designed. And we also have community engagement programs where we adhere to good participatory practice. So before we go into a community, we do community preparation, stakeholder engagement. We mobilize the community to understand the issue at hand. And then we deliver the intervention. And all the time, it's critical to always make sure that you provide feedback, meaningful feedback at a community level. And there are some wonderful examples of that, and there are some poor examples, but that we are developing and making sure that every study that we do has community involvement, even at the design of the study, and that's critical for its success to move forward. In terms of the APP funding, we note your concerns, and we will ensure, by no means we want to do not be transparent with the health committee, and I'll also ask you to address that, but we will ensure and endeavour to show you our spend in a way that you want to see it. So we do note your concerns. I'm going to ask Nick to discuss some of the funding issues, and then Sarah to discuss any further issues which I may have missed out.
Thank you. I'll just deal briefly with two of the items. I think the question on the corporate funding and the private sector funding, I agree to stress that the President has said we've had limited success there with the funding at early stage research activities. We're actually trying now to tap into some of the CSI budgets, corporate social investment budgets of some of the African corporates, also with limited success, but we will keep trying there. And then the issue on the support package, economic support package, you're correct in that that is where the funding drop off is, and it would be a worry or concern if that is a downward trend. I'm led to believe that this economic support package has a finite life, in which case we will continue to see a downward trend, which would be a concern to us. Most of our projects, our research projects, are long-term. And if you know or if there's reason to believe that your funding is dropping off in 4 to 5 years, it's very difficult to make investments in those projects now and hire people and employ staff, et cetera, if you're not sure whether the funding will be continued. So our number one wish would hope to see the support package to be converted into core funding so that we have that certainty to make the investments that we need going forward. Sarah, I don't know if you want to... Yes, sorry, Chair, and Honourable Chairperson, I will also ensure that you receive the format of the financials in the similar format that you have in the presentation. I do apologise for that oversight. Sarah, do you want to add anything on the transformation?
Can the problem address the transformation issue after the ADP issue?
Thank you. Just to add that on the transformation side, it's a pity that we did not circulate the document from which Professor Gray was looking at. But overall, the MRC has 72% females currently and 28% males. And regarding the race issues, overall we are 41% African, 22% colored, 20% Indian, and 16% white. Now, if you then add the three races, then we have quite a significant amount of blacks within the institution. It is a fact that at senior level, we still do need to transform, and it is part of the agenda that the MRC is going to try and push going forward in terms of transformation at that level. But fortunately for the institution, the next level, just below the senior level, has got a good enough pool from which to draw in order to fill the spaces at senior level and make sure that it is a fully transformed organization at that level. But overall, we are a transformed institution. And then the other question that was raised that Professor Gray did answer, which was about what happened to the human resources, i.e. human capital, after the institutions were closed. Those scientists and whoever was affected by the closure of the institutions, they were absorbed by universities and other science councils because there was, what shall I call it, they seemed to fit with the agendas of those science councils, or the universities had similar units that are dealing with those kind of researches. So fortunately, we did not contribute to unemployment in the country. Those units basically moved to universities. So that's how that works. And then the remaining, if maybe some people did not want to go to those universities, they were then absorbed within the MRC when vacancies opened in the remaining units of the MRC. So we did not contribute to further unemployment in the country. Thank you.
I'll address the question on the alignment of our targets with provincial targets. During the crafting period of the APP, the MRC ensured that we remain aligned with the National Department of Health targets. And we've seen that provincial health is aligned with national department. And in reviewing document, we were fully aligned in terms of their MDGs, NSDAs, and the department's strategic plan. So that had been covered fully. Thank you.
We will
just to emphasize two things on chair, and just to mention and give the comfort that with the revitalization that has happened, this colleagues look at 2010 and now and look at the lowest ever MRC was compared to now. That had actually already yielded good results, that we are an institution that is repeatable globally. And also perhaps to try and reiterate that revitalization has also tried to address the translation part of it. We in fact had taken most of our work to make sure that it goes to the clinic, to the hospitals. We emphasized much of our value to being extramural units. By so doing, then we are taking science to the people rather than keeping it within the institution. And that was very relevant, and that will address, of course, the disease of the people and also improve access to quality healthcare. And that's how the benefit had resulted. And whilst we are also speaking about the transformation that we are speaking about, as the council, we are not only looking at it only within the staff. As the president has said, we also are looking at historically disadvantaged institutions, which then means we take those people that don't have the opportunities and building them to be future scholars, you know, quality scholars. And the transformation that we're speaking about, we have to again qualify it. It is linked to excellence. It's not just based on color. That's what we have mentioned to the executive management, that it shouldn't be a tick box. Something that they must comply, must be, that there is quality and future professors coming out of it. And on the matter of TB, one also wants to compare again and add on what then I said about the TB, that is the cancer is also looking not only at the vaccination but also looking at how do you predict somebody's going to have recurrence as you treat them. That is very important. As you treat people, you need to know who's going to have a free treatment and so on. That's quite interesting questions that are really unanswered and that will come. And lastly, to just run the RLG, it's 1.5% of the percentage.
We will have a 10-minute break.
then we then come for the second round. Thank you, Honorable. Number T is set at the back.
Because we find out there are those who know it better. There are those who get the cream and reach at 8 o'clock in the morning and then we are late. But we are not resisting so I want to expand on that by a first page.
So I don't want to embarrass you here, but we are wrong.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. At the most, it wouldn't happen.
Thank you. 15 years to go, ne?
Nee, nee, nee. Maar hoe leidde daarbij ons? Het is misschien niet beter, het was verbeterd.
Het was beter. Het was net groot
in de jaren. In die avonden en die ochtend, nee?
Ja, in de avonden. Anders dan het gebeuren in de avond.
Het lijkt warm.
This thing wasn't alone here, it's not working.
I'm
not having your bed.
You tell me I'm better after my son's own weakness. But in the morning, I'm going to check my eye, young woman, I can't remember the name.
We are going to start can we be settled? Honorable James, can somebody call the members that are outside, or if they are still outside, we will continue without them. As we have promised, we'll then come to the second round. Honorable Mashalela, Honorable Maisela, Honorable Madiase, Honorable James, Honorable Ronwick, and I'll be the last. Thank you.
Not I'll deal with my issue will be around the budget and other related matters that has got to do with the budget and funding. Well, firstly is the, because we're dealing with the budget here and the strategic plan and the APP of the ending. My confusion is that the figures are not talking to each other in terms of the documents that we have. If you can just clarify that, because the APP document has got a different figure from the presentation that we've made. So if you can just clarify that, because the presentation is talking about 828,600,000. And then the ATP is talking about 808 million. There's a difference of about 20 million or so. So if you can note, because at the end of the day we must write a report to Parliament, and that report must reflect what is the budget of the entity. The two documents reflects different, it tells different stories. That's one issue. The second issue is around the issue around the South African Demographic Health Survey, which it's an important tool that provides valuable information, which information is also used by the WHO. For comparative analysis, and we are saying, and it also assists in terms of planning by government as a whole. But the issue is that you are unable to proceed with it because of the funding challenges. If you can just explain the details so that we understand what are the funding challenges and what are the implications of us as a country not providing that survey or doing that survey. What exactly does it mean from a planning point of view? So that at least we've got a better understanding, and then as a community maybe we have to do something about it in terms of trying to assist and intervene and engage the department. We can only engage the department if we understand what are the implications of you closing that particular task and responsibility, or maybe you close it because somebody somewhere is carrying it. And if there's no institution that is carrying it, then what are the implications? What does it mean to us as a country? And then what is that we need then to deal with that matter? Because it affects in terms of our ability to intervene in areas like your obesity, as you have reflected in your, which the minister has raised as a problem. In South Africa. Then the second matter is around the issue of the perinatal problem of identification program, which is quite in terms of the negotiated service delivery agreement, and it's part of the, and it's directly supporting this one of the strategic goals of the department, which is the re-engineering of primary health care. In terms of making sure that there's a deployment of district clinical specialists in various districts as part of the plan of, as part of the strategic goals of the department in the next coming 5 years, in order to meet the challenges or make sure that we are ready to implement the NHI. Then in order for us to do that, there must be a need to further expand this work. And I'm saying it's not possible to expand it because of the funding challenges as well. If you can just share with us so that at least we understand, because we see that you're saying, oh, the department must deal with national treasury, but we'll also be invested so that we're also in a position to engage national treasury or the expropriation I mean, the appropriation committee in Parliament, so that we're in a position to make suggestions in the appropriation committee in relation to this aspect of work. What are the implications? Why is necessary to have funding for it? So that we sensitize whoever that needs to be sensitized beyond just National Treasury and the Department itself for funding purposes. And then lastly, you have reflected that in terms of the support that you are giving to students for funding, we have indicated where are they in various institutions, but abroad, you just say abroad. Is it possible to get where abroad, which countries and which universities? Thanks.
Honorable Minister.
Thank you, Chair. If you can't diagnose a disease properly, you are unlikely to cure it properly. You are just going to do some stuff. But you may succeed, but would rather diagnose it properly. And if you diagnose it properly, then you can know the cause, and then it is easier to prevent. And prevention is better than cure. So let us focus on the preventative side of it, and diagnostically we have to do to research the social drivers of these diseases, like communicable diseases and things like that. You just mentioned that pneumococcal infection may be by implication is a killer for neonates. It's a big killer for neonates. So if you say mortality rate is down, and so which means that the life expectancy is high, is it because of a curative or a preventative or a social mobility? And those things can help, because if you do not work with the housing department or human settlement department, you find that pneumococcal infection is high and neonates die, and also streptococcus infection is high and cardiac diseases go high in future. And also the National Nutrition Supplementary Project, which has been neglected, and you can actually craft the type of nutrition that must be given to children at school, that making their immune system to be able to combat those diseases that can be combated by immune systems in the body. Because if the children are not getting enough food, they become divine thunderheads. You talked about lead project. And I think that one is maybe becoming not so much a danger, because we have alerted petrol now and all sorts of things because of the disease that is happening. And I think there is some laws that ban paint, lead in paint and toys and so on and so on. But then nobody has banned the problem of overcrowding in RDPs or informal settlement. This is a greater generator of social diseases than most of other things. Even HIV AIDS may have a genesis in the overcrowding in the informal settlements and things like that. So if you can diagnose this and say, now this is the problem, you found it, and it is for others to find the solution to it, but you would have given them the diagnosis of this pandemic. So those are some of the things which are more important, at least as far as I'm concerned, than finding a disused bottle nebulizer. Is it part of your project? It's very okay. Now that is fine, but the important thing is to make sure that these children are not exposed to those agents that causes asthma, right? And prevention is better than cure. But if you can't prevent what you can't diagnose, or what you don't have a diagnosis of, maybe let me just give us a chance, because I don't want to. I've got a few other questions here, but let me not monopolize.
Thanks, Madam Chair. The Medical Research Council's vision says that they are building a healthy nation through research and innovation. What innovation is there for you uniquely that you can? can present to this committee. But that is a way of introducing a few questions I want to raise. When are you going to have a paradigm shift from the MRC, where in which you advise government to move from disease management regime to tapping causative factors of illness and disease? Because currently all we are seeing is management of diseases, nothing else. In what you refer to as innovation, my question is, at what point are you going to invest in alternative medicines over Western drug-based medicine as provided and presented as innovation? And because the Western drug medicine is based on vaccines and vaccine running out of vaccination. In the 21st century, there are no alternative ways of finding better ways of dealing with illnesses and diseases other than to invest so much on vaccines. As a research institution, have you conducted studies on the role of GMOs on the impact of NGOs and the impact of agrochemicals on our maize, soya, and all agricultural products, because they are mainly responsible for obesity and the cause of illnesses that we seem to be managing than to deal with the causative factors. On HPV, Honorable Sal has partly covered me about that. But my major question about HPV, which is a question which must be put to you, is that by advising government each time that we have to deal with a crisis or a health situation like we're experiencing about cancer and all of that, the HPV, having been withdrawn from in Japan and in other parts of the world, the massive rollout, HPV with its side effects such as precancerous conditions, which may lead, of course, to infertility at the later stage, as well as at some stages early menopause. And all of that, this other side effects are associated with it, because HPV, in fact, in the market, worldwide, we've got more than 100 HPVs. And you have a tool to determine, to judge, of the 100 HPVs, which one are and we prescribe to our people, at what price? Or are we just in the joy of rolling and buying at massive cost to our fiscals? I'm raising this because it has got consequential and serious effects as a human reality about our young girls who HPV is administered on them. Do you, with this as a set of human reality, do you sleep with your clear conscience about the consequences which at times when they play themselves out and manifest themselves out at a massive scale, some of us will not be around yet who will be accountable and to take full responsibility? Do you go to bed and sleep with clear conscience? We are not, however, not impressed by which journals you publish your research outcomes and all of that. We'll be impressed in the future if you come next time and tell us how you have dealt and addressed the causative factors for diseases. That's important to us. Because, lastly, Madam Chair, what we see here through your friends' presentation is that you're making a good business case for more government funding. And this is as good as a massive man-eating scheme with more benefits for people, and you also don't tell us, other than to refer to GIS service in the SADC. You don't tell us about with your innovative plans, what do you present before this committee for the advancement of the African agenda? What collaborative platforms and initiatives are in place with countries in SADC as well as with countries in Africa, more than to tell us about your good relations with the West? Thank you.
Before Honorable James, there's a gentleman that has come in with the camera. I would appreciate if you can tell us who he is so that we know. I see you walking around today with the camera. Please speak up.
Good morning, Chair. My name is Trevor Simpson. I'm a photographer with Business Day.
Okay. No, the reason that I'm asking is because in my time here, it's the first time that I see a photographer in a portfolio committee. You'll pardon me. We need to be careful rather than to be sorry. But I am looking for the committee section if then that is okay. Honorable Case.
Thank you very much. I think the photographer is here to take a photo of you and not me. I just wanted to ask a question about what the thinking is within the MRC about how to gear your research operation so that you can in fact tackle vaccine development for TB. I mean, what's required is three things are required, as you know. You need brains, sufficient brains, you need sufficient money, and you need good labs. Those are the three things you require. And you mentioned structural biology, you mentioned a whole range of other discipline-specific expertise that you need to obtain either locally or internationally, and you need to build international collaboration and so on. So if I ask you a blunt question, if you were to put a figure on, just to say to my colleague from the EFF, the MRC is a research body, that's what it is, and so it's an investment in research, it can deal with health problems. So it's certainly money well spent. But to ask you a blunt question, what do you require in terms of a quantum in order to gear yourself to impact on such a high science dilemma that you have?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I just have two quick questions. Actually, one follow-up and one question. In terms of my question, I'd like to pick up on what the Honorable Maestro has been speaking about, which are very good points around social causes of health. Something I'm particularly passionate about are the social determinants of health. And of course, we know that we have the WHO Commission and their findings on Michael Moorman, which have very clear recommendations. Now, you've spoken about the fact that you do look at these determinants, but it's spread across many different units. And just as a thought, would it not perhaps be sensible to start bundling them together in a unit that looks at social determinants of health specifically? It just may allow you to focus, that's really valuable. The second was just a follow-up. I'd asked a question earlier about translation of research into policy and practice. I'm not sure that's been addressed yet. If you can, let's just pick up on that one. Thank you.
For me, just a comment, two comments. When you talk on your human resource, my observations are that you are more, make emphasis on the academic scientists. Is it the person who's making tea, who's sleeping, who's doing your admin, answering your phone, are the scientists? I'm reading this first within the codex of transmission, and one would have loved if you have given us a breakdown of your labor force. And secondly, on that are you such a healthy institution that you don't have some challenges within the labor force? Remember now in the country we have trade unions that are legislated, that have got rights. And you are silent on that. That's my concern in terms of the labor force. Secondly, We will request that we want to make this I'm not saying not taking it serious. First, questions, we want to encourage members that if they have got other questions, they can submit those, they're allowed to submit those to you, and you can respond that through the office of the chair. Same applies with the breakdown of gender. Nobody talked about class. when I'm saying class, tell us that in people that are working in MRC, who are those that are coming from well off, if I can use that, and who are those that have through their own endeavors have managed to be where they are in your institution? Because we want to, when we're talking about that, it's the whole package of transformation. On your collaboration or whatever with science and technology, you only talked about funding. I get a sense that there is, correct me, I do pick up that there is an overlap, in particular on the innovative side of it, but also into the research. Are you not duplicating? Are you, what is it that the working relations with science and technology? On page 12, which is my last question, on page 12 of your strategic planning process, bullet number is 8, bullet number 2, you haven't talked about the city grant, even in your presentation of finances. Your presentation is silent on that grant. Can we be clarified on that? I think those are the last group of questions for you. We'll allow you to respond. Thank you very much.
Honourable members, I'm going to deal with all the health-related things, and I'm going to ask specifically Nick to address the issue on the different figures. Now, either we can do the figures first, or we can do them after I've spoken, and I'm happy. Maybe let Nick go first, and then I can deal with the funds.
Can you just move the presentation to page 74? Just to provide clarity to the committee on the numbers, and I'm just comparing them to the numbers in the ADP document. If you look at 2012-13 and 2013-14, you'll see the numbers do agree. Sorry, 2011-12 and 2012-13, the 580 at the bottom, and the 2012-13, the 576, do agree exactly to the numbers on page 7 of the APP. The differences are, in the document, the 2013-40 numbers were an estimate at the time. We now have final audited numbers. So in the interest of transparency, we've included the audited numbers in the presentation because they are obviously more recent. And then in the projected outcomes for 2015-16 and 18, those are our latest forecasts, mainly as a result of the leverage funding that we're anticipating to secure as part of our fundraising project. So you can see that the actual estimated income has actually increased slightly from the numbers in the APP document. Apart from that, they are identical.
I'm going to raise the question of the demographic health survey. You're correct that the demographic health survey has been delayed, but it is still planned. And the reasons why there was some delay about the demographic health survey was that traditionally demographic health surveys just actually monitor female fertility, female deaths, and child mortality. And so it's quite elementary for the kind of demographic health survey that we want to run. So when we do our demographic health survey, not only do we want to know about female fertility, maternal pregnancies, and child death, and the competition, so it's primarily focused on maternal issues. We wanted to expand our demographic health survey to look at other burden of diseases like obesity, diabetes, hypertension, and some of the other burden of diseases we're not capturing. And we had to re-look at the design of the demographic health survey so that it could address the issue of non-communicable diseases in a much more comprehensive way than the previous demographic health surveys are run. And so we're introducing a much more complex demographic health survey than has ever been executed. normally when you start adding on modules, it takes 2 or 3 years to execute, and you have to do your first module where you do the maternal and child health, and the next module, and the next module. And so, and also, what we are in our demographic health service, we're going to be introducing some cutting edge things like blood spots for biomarkers, HIV diagnosis. So the whole planning for this comprehensive demographic health survey to meet the needs of the department is a lot more complicated than what previously anticipated. And so the demographic health guru has spent weeks with us and the Department of Health to look at the best way to execute this. So we've been working with StatsSA and with the Department of Health and with the experts in demographic health survey to make sure that we get the survey right. Because if we don't get the survey right, then we wasted money. And so we're on target. We plan to pilot the demographic health survey in September, October this year. We are in discussions with the Department of Health to discuss the additional financial implications of having an extended demographic survey, and we're working very closely with them around the budgetary issues. But it is our plan to execute the demographic health survey in a way that addresses all the country's needs and not just issues around reproductive health. And that's a very important survey. It's ongoing, and we're working very closely with the Department of Health to execute it and with FSA. The additional funding, we are talking to the Department of Health regarding if there are any anticipated shortfalls. So we're working on the budgets, we're working on the drug laptops, we're working out who can take it. So a lot of the implementation has already been executed as we discuss how we embark on it's almost 17,000 households, maybe even more, to make sure that we get the right mix of households to get the right answers. In terms of the perinatal priorities, you are correct. We need to re-engineer our primary healthcare clinics. We need to understand health system strengthening. If we are going to meet the challenges of the national health insurance, we have to make sure that our primary healthcare and our hospitals are ready for it. And so we're very committed to research on health system strengthening. And we have a health system strengthening. We have a health systems research unit that is addressing some of these issues and that is working with the Department of Health to understand some of the issues. For example, we did the PMCCT evaluation to make sure that to look at the structural issues that were involved in our health system that made a child more susceptible to HIV than normal. So we agree with the fact that we need good research in health systems. We heard last week with the Honourable Minister of Health how he's committed to primary health care and how we understand the issues of human resources and human capital and how we need to strengthen it. And MRC needs to work and is working to address the kind of human resource issues and challenges that are faced in the primary health care areas. And we also are working in pilot areas of the NHIE to help give the Department of Health an understanding of the demographics and the burden of disease in those pilot projects like in the Eastern Cape. So we are committed. I don't think I've answered your question very carefully, but you can come back and ask me for further clarification. In terms of students abroad, yes, we should have explained to you where they were. Some students have gone to PAMEC. I told you we have a PAMEC facility, a world-class. We want 2 PAMEC facilities in Africa, and we sent one of our PhD students to go abroad to learn from the best practices of how you manage a non-human PAMEC facility and learn what the new practices are and to learn some of the new techniques involved in working with non-human primates. So that's where the one has gone. We have a bioinformatics program in South Africa that is in its infancy, and so we're developing a whole bioinformatics program. And so we're sending biostatisticians, people with a bioinformatics expertise, to learn from the very best in Harvard and at the University of Alabama to look at the whole approach to bioinformatics. We're also sending some scientists to various institutions. The one is at the VRC, the Vaccine Research Center, to learn methodology in the lab. And there are other scientists also at other universities like Columbia University, Seattle, who are learning particular techniques that will help us in the lab as we conduct some of our research. So basically, it's getting skills up to add value to the kind of work that we do. In the future, we'll put their racial composition and their gender, and you'll be happy to know that most of the students studying abroad are actually black female scientists. In terms of, I would love, honourable member, I'd love to, you know, we could spend the whole day discussing the issues around the social drivers of disease, and I cannot agree with you more about your position. And I agree with you that you can't diagnose and cure and treat either, which is the important thing about prevention. And prevention is two things. You know, prevention is it could be a vaccine, where you prevent childhood diseases, or prevention could be understanding what causes obesity and early childhood nutrition, and is predictor of adult onset obesity. And we need to understand, we need more work in the social determinants of disease, particularly in South Africa. It's important to say that lots of babies in South Africa die of group B strep pneumonia, and we don't have a group B strep vaccine. We are busy working with scientists to develop a group B strep vaccine, and we're working with BioVac in terms of being able to manufacture the vaccine. So if we find the group B strep vaccine, Africans must be able to manufacture it, and we're working with BioVac in able to scale up the production of this. In terms of TB overcrowding, you are right. There are lots of things that cause disease because of overcrowding. You know, even we know that in specific geotypes like informal settlements, HIV is much more prevalent in a geotype of informal peri-urban settlements than anywhere else, and we need to address this. And so unless we do address the social determinants of disease, some of the interventions that we have are going to be hard to roll out, and prevention is better than cure. And if we can understand some of these issues, how we prevent drug abuse, how we prevent alcohol abuse, how we stop people from smoking, how we deal with the nicotine addiction, you know, all those things will help us. And so we need to do a lot of work in that area. In terms of there is a program called the Savings Brains Initiative that deals with early brains and nutrition, and how we invest in the early brain. They say the first 1,000 days of a child's life is the most critical, and if you can intervene there, you know, the child will do better forever. And we are going to be partnering with the Grand Challenge that's going to address early. So later on this year, there'll be in October, we will be announcing a partnership to address HIV transmission and saving brains. And saving brains, and what do we have to do to save kids' brains? In terms of lead, yes, we've done lots of work, but we're still finding pockets of lead poisoning in children, particularly in fishermen villages where they smelt those things that you fish with, sinkers, where they smelt them over a stove, and the children are in there and they're smelling it. And so we're finding that particularly in certain pockets that we do have these issues. And so even though at global level, you know, we're eradicating lead levels, but we have to go into certain pockets of our communities to find those children and stop them getting lead poisoning. We know that there are agents that cause asthma, and we know that pollution impacts on asthma and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, which we have to work on. We also know that gunshots have lead. Guns have lead, and lead has been associated with violence. So we need to find the relationship between lead levels and violence in our society. And so I agree with you about the bottle. And I think that we need devices that are cheap and reproducible, and that we can roll out and that are easy to carry. So I would agree that we need to modernize our devices and coke bottles. We could do better than that in the future. In terms of innovation, in terms of, I'm just going to break over my notes here, I'm addressing the Honourable member who spoke about exactly what are we doing and what is our innovation and what is uniquely important about the Medical Research Council. And so one of our innovations, you know, is this Doppler machine that's sitting out here, because that has the potential to avert 1 in 3, 1 in 4 neonatal deaths. And so that's an innovation that we are involved in. We're just about to bring to market an HIV-resistant diagnostic evaluation system that a nurse can understand the HIV-resistant pattern of her patient and make the best choice without having to phone up a doctor. So that's an innovation. And you can't begin to understand the backroom kind of work that it has to be done on genetics and understanding of HIV resistance to end up with a paper like this on your cell phone that just that tells you exactly what's happening and how to treat the participants. So that for me is innovation. And the fact that South African vaccinologists designed two vaccines for HIV that are in human development, are understanding the way we need to do optimize, that for me is innovation. So in terms of our diagnostics, if we get this urine test for TB, that's innovation. And so I do think that we are definitely working in the innovation phase. In terms of alternative medicine, we continue to invest. And if you've seen my slide there, you would see that we continue to invest in indigenous knowledge system, and we continue to support universities that are involved in indigenous knowledge system. We have already catalogued about 120 plants in the Eastern Cape. Everything from plants that could prevent gangrene to plants that can address the issues around nutrition. So we are clearly aware that modern medicine is not the only thing that we need to invest in. In terms of, I was at the budget vote last week, and I heard the Honourable Parliamentarian talk about Chinese medicine, and we need evidence-based, you know, so I think that we have to investigate everything, but everything has to be evidence-based, and we have to understand the mechanisms of the infection or the medicine. And you are right, you know, aren't there better ways of treating people? You are completely right. You know, we need to move into the personalized medicine arena. And in terms of at a global level, personalized medicine, you know, is becoming the way that people do medicine. You get your gene, your whole genetic sequence analyzed, and basically depending on your susceptibility to disease, people engineer and develop a suite of interventions for you that may help you avert cancer or your hypertension. But that is, and I like where you're going, because that is where that spectacular investment in science to be able to do personalized medicine and actually have an epigenetic way approach of disease. So I really agree with you on that point. In terms of the role of the GMO, we do have an agricultural research council who's integrally involved in some of the agrochemicals in maize and soy that may lead to obesity. And so we will engage with them, but we don't want to overlap our mandate to make sure that we're doing synergistic work and not just duplicative work. So we will allow them to do their development in the GMO space, because that's the appropriate expertise in the country. In terms of HPV, there are many serotypes of HPV, human papillomavirus, and there are certain subtypes or serotypes that cause cervical cancer. At the moment, there are only two HPV vaccines on the market, one by Merck and one by GSK. There aren't 100. There are only two, and GSK has designed its HPV vaccine to work on against two serotypes. Merck has designed its vaccine to work against six, and is about to bring in a new vaccine that now protects against nine serotypes of HPV. We know that HPV causes cancer, and I speak very well because I gave my daughter's HPV vaccine. You know, when my 14-year-old, just before she became sexually active, and I gave it to her, and I gave my second child, and I'm waiting for my boy to be 14 now and give him the HPV vaccine. So I am happy. I sleep better at night knowing that my children, my girl children are protected from cervical cancer, and my boy's child will not get penile cancer, and he will not transmit HPV to his sexual partner. And so I think that it's very important. I just wish that we were manufacturing HPV ourselves, but you are right, honorable member. I wish we were manufacturing HPV vaccine, because it does cost a lot of money. You know, it costs a lot of money. And we need to address the inequities of health and make sure and understand why this vaccine is so expensive and why it's not affordable. And that also part of the social determinant of disease is also about the availability of affordable medicine for you know, while people getting rich, you know, from things that can save people's lives. And that's an important discussion as well. In terms of before a vaccine can get into humans, extensive preclinical testing is done in vaccines, and we do reproductive toxicity. We look there's a whole lot of safety measure that one has to engage in before you can even get into a human. And the regulatory authorities the world over, whether it's Swiss Pharma, the Medicines Control Council, or the FDA, they have very strict criteria before they allow a vaccine into humans. And in HPV, before they allow the HPV in younger people, you evaluate it in older people, then you go down until you find data that it's safe to immunize 14 or 15-year-olds. And all this has been done. There's a clear analysis of the path to licensure with HPV. I agree with you that you know, we should not just be publishing in high-impact journals, and that we should be making sure that not only are we doing high-end research, but the research that we do has value for South Africans. And that is something that we are discussing at a national level. You know, how do we make sure that the government money that we produce, you know, produces as value for the citizen in the country, and that we're committed to making sure happens. And I think I've shown, and I think if you do read the literature, we've shown that spending, you know, in health and spending in health R&D creates wealth. And so I would say that spending in medical research council creates health and creates wealth, and is a good value for the government funding. In terms of the issue around vaccine development for TB, that you need brains, money, good labs, and an approach that is innovative. So it is true that in South Africa and the world over, we have not invested enough in TB disease. And you may say, why not? It's because TB disease is no longer a problem in the developed world, and so they got disinterested in it. And so the way we approached TB disease and infection was quite piecemeal. And at long last, and largely overdue, you know, the appropriate kind of money is beginning to flow into TB vaccine research, because we're worried pipeline is limited. You know, we still don't have a TB vaccine to prevent TB disease. And what does it take? You know, how have we approached it? And so, you know, we need more than a billion rand as an initial investment in TB research if we really wanted to make a substantial program. I've been speaking to my chair about a program in understanding the human lung, because if we could understand the human lung, we could understand TB, we could understand asthma, we could understand mesothelioma, we could understand how the lung works with pollution. And understanding that lung means that we can address the stuff that kills and affects our people in South Africa. So we need a lot of money, and at least in the beginning a billion rand just for a TB vaccine agenda. The social causes and determinants of disease, how do you address that? And, you know, do we put it all in one unit, or do we like the transdisciplinary approach? And I prefer transdisciplinary because we have new brains. You know, I need new brains, new thoughts. I need bioengineers to think about the social determinants of disease. You know, I need you know, I need lab scientists, you know, because I bring in new ideas, they generate ideas. The people that are working in the social determinants, maybe we're thinking in the same way, and we're not thinking in an innovative way. So we do have to address how we do it. And we do need to, in terms of the translation into research policy and practice, we need to be better communicators as scientists, and we need to understand that when you say you reduce mortality from one in 42, one in 165, people may not understand that that's value, and maybe we need to learn. Do we say we reduce infant mortality from 20% to less than 2%? So we need to know how to use the figures so that we can, so people know exactly what this means, and we need to work out how we communicate science so that we can ensure that that gets taken up and that policymakers can you know, take up the intervention and obvious to them. We also need to always talk about cost effectiveness, cost saving, affordability, and you know, and quality of life issues. And we need to put that into our speak all the time so that the politicians or the people who hold our positions can understand why it's important to move in that direction. So we have to learn to be better communicators. In terms of the transformation of the workforce, Honourable Chairperson, you note that we have been, you know, we've spoken about the scientists and we've been silent in our workforce. I do have the distribution, yeah, of our workforce, and in terms of people, the white collar workers, I don't know the right term, you know, that there is transformation there at every level, and the MRC has been successful. And you can give specific, things, identification of that. In terms of our unskilled and semi-skilled people, we have, I can give you an example. In terms of females, we have 47 African, 9 coloured, 10 Indian and 6 white. In terms of the males, we have 18 African, 7 coloured, 2 Indians and no whites. And that's in the semi-skilled and semi-skilled area. So we can give you these figures, and maybe in future we'll make sure that we put up slides that show both our scientists, the support of scientists, and our workforce are involved in other operations, and to demonstrate to you how we're dealing with diversity, gender issues, class, and that's a very important thing. So although we've been good at dividing people up into women, men and women, and into ethnicity, we haven't dealt with the class issues. And I like the idea, and you know, I'm going to address that at the MRC because I think it's a very important thing to address the issue around class. In terms of your concern about DST funding and whether there is overlap, we work very closely with the Department of Health and the Department of Science and Technology, and they are on all our steering committees, and they see how we allocate money. So if you see how the way we do our, how we divide our money, it's impossible to overlap. You know, there's discrete ways of funding, and in terms of the way we submit grants and we send our money, we're very sure we know who paid for what, and you know, maybe we can show that in a better way in the future. But I'm not worried about innovation overlap. You know, I'm worried about it being too little money for innovation overlap. So I'm happy to take any more questions, and if you need some clarification on the way I answered, I'm very happy to do that. Kalipa, do you want to address anything more about the transformation, the demographics of our workforce?
Thank you. I'd just like to add that we have two streams mainly, the researchers as well as the support function. And because of our core business being research, we therefore have about 78% of our employees being scientists or people working directly in research, and about 22 being in support. And support, it starts right at the bottom, the tea ladies, your cleaners, etc., but that's the semi-skilled group, which is about 22%. And within that 70% of scientists, it's your professional people as well who are within the support areas. We also have a very good program of accelerated development as well as study support. So you can have people coming in with a diploma, for instance, and 10 years later they have a PhD. And that is applicable to all employees, regardless of whether you are in the support sector or you are directly in the search. Some of us came in with junior degrees and we are now doing our PhDs and we are within the support sector. So that's just how robust our capacity development or skills development program is, and it is applicable right across. It is zoned specifically only support scientists. Because of course, if you don't have good support functions, your science is going to suffer. So we're trying to balance it in both ways. The other question that was raised was regarding page 12 of our strategic plan, bullet number 2, where we talk about the process of developing the strategic plan, which was informed by the state review. And I heard that it seems as if this was, bullet number 2 was misread in the sense that it says state review as well as grant conditions. State review is not linked to grants. It's just a process that the MRC goes through every 5 years or 3 years, or depending on the need at the time, to really look at how the institution is performing, where are the areas that are needed for improvement, etc. It is not linked to funding at all. That is why you do not see a figure that speaks to SETI in the finances. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I don't know whether you want to...
Madam Chair, because of...
There are two hands. I'm looking to the time. We are to break for lunch to prepare for the next presentation. But it's fine. If anybody still wants to ask questions, it's okay with me. Before you respond to that, when then you respond, you take...
Because of what the honourable members were mentioning about social determinants, which are important, the council has recognised that and we agree with that. Although we also have to make honourable members aware that we collaborate with the Research Council, which their mandate is primarily to deal with those factors. So Oliver Fisher's council is working close with us. So some of the things we don't want to repeat. And I can just mention on what the Honourable Chairperson has said, we do have a union as well in the CNC.
Honourable Mashalela and Honourable Maestro Delas.
No, no, Chair, I'm not raising a new question. I'm sure whether those that are compiling the report have understood the CFO. I didn't understand it. But if those that are writing the report have understood him, I'm fine. But I'm saying I didn't understand his explanation. Firstly, he was not explicit. What budget are you presenting to us for this financial year? Are you amending what you have presented in this in the ATP? Or what? You're not very clear. Because the budget that is in the APP and what is in the slides is not the same. That's the issue. Could have just clarified that matter. So that you know that you are amending what is in the APP. So that you know that because we're not going to adopt the slides. We're going to adopt the APP. So if you don't tell us that no, the figures that are in the APP, if I'm amending it, the figure that you must take are those that are in the slides. Because in the slides is 828 million. In the APP it's 808. So that's a clarity that I was sorting, so that at least we move in the same direction. And then you're saying those funds 2013-14 are audited. And then the one in the APP are not audited. So it means you still have to amend this one so that when you adopt the APP, the figures that are in the slides for 2013-14 are the same as the one that you have presented in the APP. So that we know what we are adopting and then finally we understand. That's the thing that I was not very clear on. But as I'm saying, if those that are writing the report are clear about it, it's fine. The second issue, President, you explained the question, but there is an element that still missing, the funding element. I didn't get what you are telling me on the funding element, on the two issues that I've raised. Because I want
it was in the report on page 7, it says no, you're unable to conduct the democratic survey because of funding problem. But in your explanation, you're saying no, you're expanding the survey. But in the report, in the AP, in the strategic plan, you are saying, no, you can't, you are not proceeding because of a funding problem. But in your explanation, you are saying, no, you are expanding, because it was very narrow. And that confuses me, because we must know whether you have got a challenge of funding, so that man, if you have got a challenge of funding, then you engage the department to give you fund to be in a position to expand. How do you expand why you have got the funding problem? You didn't come up clear. I'm not sure whether you're afraid of the DTG.
I'm sorry to respond.
The same thing applies to your perinatal identity. You're saying no, it needs additional capital injection and the matter must be jointly resolved by National Treasure. That's what you're saying on the perinatal problem identification program. You want to expand and do the work, but you can't proceed because there's a funding challenge. But when you respond, you don't say that. Because I was saying, clarify us that, so that we can seem to engage the department and also engage the appropriation committee in parliament here. And also reflect what are your funding needs in relation to these two items, so that we're in a position then to motivate to the appropriation committee that even if the department is failing with HR, why then in a position to engage the appropriation committee and all those other. I'm still not very clear. That's the issue that I was raising, because you're running away from it.
Maybe they've got money. My question, I didn't want to harp on it and raise it, but it keeps on cropping up and the figures don't tell about the transformation. I thought I discussed it on the sidelines to kill it, but it keeps on cropping up and the figures don't tell it. And what makes me to come back to it is because the lady just said that the support group right up to PhD level, but in the documents you said that you've done away with apprenticeship. How do you come and do those things? And two, you've got a 9 European PhD students and 3 blacks and 3 colors and Indians. And I told her that if you do this, you're not going to catch up, because these are the people that are going to carry a part and push up. And if there's this disparity, it will take 300 years maybe, when the others don't want to do the type of job that the others can catch up. But you see, transformation is not something that we ask for. We instruct. It must be done. It's not a favor. It's government policy that transformation must take place. It's not something that, well, you can do it. No, slow. In fact, we don't want to say, when you come back here, the figures must have changed drastically according to the demographics. But we just want to be nice and talk about it in a nice way, right? So please, when you give us figures, let them make sense and tally. He just showed your figures that don't tally. Even in the demographic figures don't tally. So maybe you need a mathematician. Let's get it. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Michel. I don't know who wants to start.
I was just going to say, in protection of the President, we really take fault for the figure not telling, but it's again, we're doing the AP according to a specific way because of the manner in which we're instructed that it has to be presented. We have also contributed to that. It was not money.
I request that you use the mic and also talk to the chair. Please.
Apologies, Honorable Chair. Just to indicate that it's a matter of timing and the way that we are required to comply with the PSMA and Treasury regulations. So what happens is that we hand in the APP and strategic plan for approval by the Minister for submission to Parliament. And that's why the column in the APP is marked estimated. So we're not asking for any revision of the numbers. The numbers remain as is. When we do the adjustment appropriation bill, the figures would then be updated accordingly because we will have the audited outcome. So maybe just to also add that as a board member and serving, I think, those of us who are here in our second term, it really is completely remarkable the journeys that have been travelled. Because if we had come to you in 2010, those figures weren't even reliable. Now we've got reliable figures, and there's no contradiction really. There isn't any contradiction between the figures because, and we can submit to you with the estimated figure for 2013-14 and then the final audited outcome. So if you see on the slide as it's projected, it's got audited outcome and that is including 2013-14 because we already know what our audit outcome is. And that money is doing far more than it used to do in prior years because of the improvements and in efficiency and effectivity. So I hope that reassures, and my suggestion is that the President gives you all of that so that you can see there are no contradictions between the figures. It's just timing in relation to the legislative framework.
I don't know, I just want to check. I can see now that there is another hand before I allow you. Are you, is an addition on the matter?
No.
Or a different matter? You want to respond on? Okay, go ahead.
Thanks, Chair. I think I need to clarify the demographic council because I think the President may have some difficulty responding because she wasn't there at the time. The challenge has been that the National Treasury allocated funding directly for the demographic and health survey to the Department of Children transferred to the MRC. At the time when the demographic health survey was supposed to be done, the funds that were allocated were inadequate for the MRC to do that, and so it was impossible for them to do it in time. So what we did instead is that we asked the HHRC to do a lower-level survey, if you want to call it that, in terms of the type of data that you normally get out of a demographic and health survey, which is called the Sandhane survey that was done. However, we have convinced the Treasury, I think, that the demographic health survey is critical for South Africa to know exactly what's happening with the population over time. And we're hoping that the Treasury is convinced of this, and going forward, they will continue to fund the survey independently. Because this was not funded in our baseline in the department, it was funded independently as an earmark funding for a demographic council.
Madam Chair, Honourable Madam Chair. Yes, thank you. So, that was a very good explanation. In terms of the, I'm not just going to respond to some of the questions that the honourable members have, or am I out of order?
No, I thought you were going to respond.
I am.
What do you have been there?
Yes. So I'm going to respond. First of all, it's a PhD program, and so what you saw was a merger. When we reviewed our capacity development and PhD program, we saw this was a faulty, and so we got together the best academics to try and streamline a process that got PhDs from medical sciences. And so what you've seen is you've seen the past, the present is there's some overlap, and in the future, we'll start to phase out some of the other projects and have a much more directed PhD program. So what you see is the in-between, the new program starting and the old program being phased out. So that's why it looks a bit confusing. And I'm happy to take you through the thinking of the new program, made it much more streamlined. We worked with the National Research Foundation, and we're working with the universities to make sure that every PhD that we fund is successful. Looking at support programs for them and looking at additional training they may require so that they can be successful. So that's what you've seen in our PhD program. In terms of talent management, Madam Chair, Honourable Madam Chair,
we are committed to transformation at the MRC. You know, we have gone through every unit and every department, and we have a plan about transformation that we hold everybody to, including myself, who will be replaced, you know, in 5 years or less by someone that represents the demographic distribution of the country. So even myself, you know, I'm committed to transforming the organization, even my job. And you know, you will, you can hold me to that. I promise. In terms of the honourable member, you talk well about the NHI, and yes, we do have some money allocated to the National Health Insurance and support, and we are working with the Department of Health to see how we realise the, you know, what additional funding we need. You know, we want to meaningfully support the National Health Department in its execution of National Health Insurance. And so we're working closely with the Department of Health to see exactly where we should put the money and how much more money we need, either from the Department of Health or from Treasury, to see what's the best program. So that is, you're quite right to for you to see that. That is something that we are working together for with the Department of Health.
All right, I think let's thank the MRC for the report and the explanations, but some of them a bit confusing, but we need more time. But we will come back to you as the committee in areas where we feel that you have not been coming forth for us to be able to understand. Remember, the Honourable Mashalela did say that we are to report, we are to make some recommendations, and if you're not coming up forth, it then becomes a little bit of a problem. In fact, he was saying, tell us what you want. And he was short to saying, but he did say that you are too much very diplomatic, whether you are scared or well, that's what you are here for. And it will be. So I do think that is very important. And in that, when we'll be sending you some of the response and questions, we'll appreciate in responding that on time, so that we're also able, in terms of our report, the areas where we think that we need to clear them up. And hoping that you know that we will still be very hard on issues of transformation, that we're not apologetic, we'll never be apologetic, because if institutions of your nature, entities of your kind, we don't see any move in terms of transformation, it then means we have got a serious problem. I've got one or two questions that I'm going to write and ask, still on transformation and other entities of science and technology, which I do think that you were a bit silent on them, on your working relations. I will write a question on that, and I hope you will be able to respond satisfactorily. With that, thank you very much. Until we meet again, we will call you Senator. We will definitely call you, because you are key in listening to the questions from members. You see that we are a group that I can say we are activists in health, and we'll never be apologetic about that. That is this committee in the state administration. Thank you very much. So I will request members of the portfolio committee just to remain for 2 seconds. We want to deal with the business of the committee, so the more you stay, the more you delay us.
If you see that there is a agenda item that talks about minutes, we didn't talk about that. We want to propose that we deal with that after the second presentation, so that members can quickly do their stuff if they want to do that. Once the second presentation is going to be at 2 o'clock. Then after that, we're going to be dealing with the minutes. Is that fine, members? Okay. All right. Lunch, is it going to be served here? Is it on its way? Oh, lunch is on the reserve.
You are privately and secretly promoting expropriation without compensation. Privately.
So, I merely asked Mamu, why the Mama Lua over what?
Who's Mongi?
Yeah. Who has to boom? Uche upuze ipanje chamana. Mwana kwe salamu.
Uche chamana. Kumnande parlamente. Kumnande parlamente.
On Friday, he supported ipanje chamana. He never opposed it. Now I don't come and report a comment on health on the same party. There's no consistency in this thing. They should have started with the budget. Then by rejecting the report.
Report.
But accept the budget for rejecting the report. Mangabuzala, but you know, something that we missed in the report. And that thing that we want to be made, we never discussed, it never arose in the meeting. But if I'm on the island, I'm going to get in the
morning.
Is it not afraid? I must attend a meeting now, Eva, which I think she also has.
Thank you.